We'll proceed initially in the matter of Elisa B. versus Superior Court, Emily B., Real Parties in Interest, and hearing first from Ms. Reed Spangler.
May it please the Court. All children are entitled to support from both people who intentionally brought the children into the world. And all children are entitled to support from a person who intentionally creates a parent-child relationship when she takes the children into her home and holds them out as her own. Both of these ideas existed at common law and have been incorporated into the UPA, which was enacted to eliminate the discrimination of children based on their parents' marital status.
And which statutory provisions support your position in particular?
In particular, Section 7613A and Section 7611D, which don't rely on biology, but rather look at intent and conduct of the people involved. In particular, 7613 doesn't rely on biology, but instead looks at the party's intent and conduct when, as this court found in Johnson, the parties consented to artificial insemination and said, but for their acted on intention, the child would not exist.
And for equal protection purposes, does it make any difference if it's a man and a woman, two men or two women, if their intent is to bring children into the world?
No, in fact, for the equal protection rights of the child, the statute must be read so that it must apply without regard to the marital status of the parties involved. So it must apply without regard to the gender of the people involved.
What do you say to the argument that that's stretching the words of the statute? Do you think that the constitutional principles justify giving it that expanse of a meaning?
Although the statute says husband and wife, a literal or wooden reading of the statute to say husband and wife would actually undermine and defeat the purpose of the statute and violate equal protection. Otherwise, if you don't apply it equally, you'll be creating a subset of illegitimate children, both of unmarried opposite sex couples and unregistered same-sex couples. Thus, to implement the intent of the statute, which is to find that parents who intend to be parents and consent to the assisted reproduction of their spouse or their partner or are actually parents, you must read out the marital aspect of that statute. So yes, it can't be read literally. And in fact, the comment to the model UPA statute said that this is just one of the more common methods, and it was not intended to foreclose the courts from looking and interpreting the parentage of children born via other methods of assisted reproduction.
Mrs. Reed Spangler, is it your position that if two people are cohabiting and one partner agrees that the other should have a baby, that first partner is the baby's parent?
You use the word agree, which is somewhat vague. If our position is that where two people consent with the intent to be the parent of the resulting child, then both of those people should be the legal parent of the resulting child with the attendant rights and responsibilities.
What if the father were a known person? Could this child, under your view, have three parents?
No. The UPA, and as this court recognized in Sharon S., the UPA and the Family Code clearly limit the number of legal parents to two parents. Now, that father might have be able to assert parentage, but at the end of the day, there could only be two legal parents.
And yet you were saying that we can disregard the limitation to husband and wife, so why is it that the two-parent limitation would prevail?
I'm not sure I understand your question.
Well, a moment ago you were saying that the literal language of the statute wouldn't necessarily prevail with regard to the limitation to husband and wife, or man and woman.
Yes.
And you're saying in response to Justice Werdiger's question, well, the statute says there can only be two parents. And I'm saying, why do you feel that you have to adhere to the wording of the statute when it comes to numbers but not classifications of parents?
As I said, there are many provisions throughout the Family Code and the UPA which clearly limit the number of legal parents to two parents. And although the UPA strives to find two parents, it only does limit it to two legal parents. And the courts have already looked at a number of cases where there have been more than two parents seeking parental rights and have consistently been able to balance and weigh those interests and find only two legal parents. And we are certainly not proposing a rule that would start expanding beyond two parents.
How do you get around our language in Johnson versus Calvert, where we said that for any child, California law recognizes only one natural mother?
Johnson was a very different situation where there was a married intended couple seeking parentage as well as a gestational surrogate seeking parentage, and that only one natural mother comment was made where there would have been the anomalous result of three parents. There would to find three parents who would have broken up an extant two-parent family, and you would have defeated the intent of that intended the party's intention. Also, since Johnson, this court has found in Sharon S. that same-sex that parents can be, a same-sex couple could be parents through adoption. Moreover, through the recent enactment of AB 205, the legislature has certainly indicated that it wants to provide equal rights and obligations to same-sex parents and their children. So to the extent that Johnson stood for the proposition that you couldn't have two parents of the same sex, it's no longer valid.
Counsel, how do you distinguish between the receiving prong and the holding out prong of the statute? Are they the same?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the first part.
How do you distinguish between the receiving prong, part of the prong, and the holding out as a natural child? Are they the same?
The taking into the home?
Yes,
and
the receiving. And do we have to make a distinction between receiving and holding out?
Well, the important factor under 7611D, as the court has repeatedly emphasized, is the creation of the parent-child relationship. And although the person takes them into their home, the courts strive, even over a biological relationship, to maintain that parent-child relationship. In all of the cases before the court today, the non-biological mother did take the children into her home and held them out as her actual child. I don't know that there's really needs to be a clear distinction. That clearly would be a factor to be looked at when you look at the parent-child relationship. But there are also other factors that you could look at in determining whether there's a strong parent-child relationship, whether the parent has helped select the children's names, given them one of their names. But again, you look at the party's conduct and intention with respect to that child.
If we agree with you that Elisa is the parent of these twins, does it follow that your client is the parent of Elisa's child?
Yes. It absolutely follows, because they both selected the sperm donors together with the intention of creating a family. Their children are half-siblings, and they did that, and they picked the children's names together. Their children have hyphenated last names. They did that deliberately so that they would be viewed as a family, and they were viewed as a family. And they both have reciprocal rights and responsibilities to the other's children.
All right, your time is up. We'll hear now from Ms. Hamilton. Thank you, Ms. Reed Spangler.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, I'm Mary Jane Hamilton. I'm representing El Dorado County, more specifically El Dorado County's Department of Child Support Services. The county initiated this case in 2001 when it filed the summons and complaint regarding parental obligations against Elisa.
Ms. Hamilton, to put things in context and to
right.
make it easier to follow the various legal arguments presented in this highly complex case,
exactly.
I just want to make sure that you and I are in agreement as to the pertinent facts in this particular case.
Right.
Elisa, is that the correct pronunciation, or is it Elisa?
Elisa. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We had a discussion about that earlier this morning amongst us, Elisa.
At least we got one thing straight. Elisa and her partner, Emily, decided they wanted to have children.
Right.
So they arranged through a sperm bank to become artificially inseminated.
Right.
Elisa. Has a healthy son. Emily bore twins, and one of the twins, the boy, was quite disabled, as I recall, suffering from severe heart defect and Down syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
Emily has to take care of the twins, especially the special care that
she's
needed
the caregiver of the twins,
for the little boy.
Mm-hmm.
Elisa becomes the main breadwinner. And after a while, they split.
Exactly.
Elisa, as I understand the record,
right.
for some time continues to pay the mortgage on the home. And by now I've forgotten how much it was, but I thought about $1,500.
Mm-hmm.
And after Emily then moved into an apartment, right. Elisa continued to pay the rent on the apartment.
As she was able, yes.
Yes, and I think at one point she lost her permanent
her income,
or whatever
it was. Part of her income, yes.
And Emily, needing to take care of the children, especially the disabled child, turns to your county, El Dorado County, and asks for financial assistance.
That's
she
right.
gets that, and I gather that Emily also is getting paid for being the caretaker of the disabled child. And at one point, El Dorado County then wants a determination of paternity and wants to know whether under the law Elisa can be held legally liable. And now we're getting into the legal issues. What exactly in the statutory scheme that doesn't seem to exactly fit this particular situation? What in that statutory scheme do you think helps your position?
Well, I would say that Family Code 17,400 and following. It's a long section, but it is absolutely requires a county, when child or children end up on public assistance, to establish parentage for that child.
Of course,
with the goals.
As you and I know, taking a look at the legislative scheme, and taking a look at what
17,400, is that right?
7611, that's what I'm looking at.
Oh, you're looking at this.
Of the family code.
Mm-hmm.
That says a man is presumed to be the natural father if he meets any of the following subdivisions.
That's right.
Leaving aside subdivisions that don't apply here, we take a look at subdivision D, which says he receives the child into his home, openly holds out the child as his natural child. Is this a provision in the statutory scheme that you, the county, are relying on?
Yes, that statutory scheme from the 1970s, as it has been interpreted by case law and a cognizant of their duty under 17,400 to determine parentage. Now, I agree that 7600 says refers only to men. At the beginning of 17,400, it refers to paternity, but if, as we read the newer statutes in 17,400, it says parentage.
What, Ms. One more question, Justice Brown.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, so we feel we have a duty to seek...
Leaving aside the provision that you gave to me in response to my question...
Exactly.
What do we do with 7650, because 7611 pertains to men? Is 7650 of any help to you, where it says that the mother and child relationship, as practicable, mm-hmm. can apply to the father and child provision? And, of course, I just mm-hmm. read that. That's 7611. So are you relying on 7650 to read that in harmony with the father-child provision?
Yes, I think the answer to that is yes, because we read the Uniform Parentage Act to require general, neutral application of that act. In the mid-70s, medically assisted reproduction was much less sophisticated than it is today. Today, we can actually separate a biological contribution from a personal contribution. In this case, on these facts, both women chose a third-party anonymous sperm donor. They eliminated the male from this family so that they could take on the role of parenting this family.
Well, since you have given an answer to my question, Justice Brown.
Yes.
Ms. Hamilton, think that you were relying on this, the presumed father statute, this holding out as part of the
this holding out
for
in
financial
this particular
responsibility
case, yes.
here. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. My question is, if in that circumstance you had a male who mm-hmm. was who held out the child and so forth, wouldn't that male be able to escape financial responsibility by demonstrating that he was in fact not the biological father?
7611D is in a statutory provision that said there are often several presumptions that would apply, and that the court then must choose the presumption that is best interest, well, I'm going to use a cliche, best interest of the child. That I don't believe that's quite the statutory language. But there very often are competing parents. In Nicholas H., there was clearly a biological father. There was clearly a nurturing father. And the court was put to the decision as to who would be the legal father.
I understand that. That's
yes, uh-huh.
What I'm really trying to get at is on what basis mm-hmm. do we decide that Alyssa is financially obligated to support these twins?
As the intentional parent.
Well, preceding counsel said two things. She said mm-hmm. Children are entitled to support when people intentionally bring that child into the world,
yes.
and they're entitled to support when a person takes a child into his home and holds that child out.
Yes.
And my question is that argument in the disjunctive or the conjunctive? Do you need both of those things, or do you need something more than that?
Well, I've never seen them disjunctive, but I guess it could possibly be that one would be a biological father and one would be the nurturing father or the biological parent, the nurturing parent. The holding out and the receiving is, frankly, I think it's estoppel in the statute, to tell you the truth, because it is wonderful evidentiary evidence of what the intention of those parties were. Very often, by the time we enter a case, the intention of the adults is what we are trying to ascertain.
But the intent certainly could come to an end before the child was actually born.
Well, certainly Mr. Buzanka, in the Buzanka case, thought his intent to have a child via his wife and there was no biological connection in Buzanka, which is a court of appeals case, but neither the father nor the mother was in a position to contribute biologically, and they procured a fertilized embryo to implant in a gestational woman, and Mr. Buzanka was sought divorce before the child was even born, and he said, I'm out of here. I have no children. I have no biological tie, et cetera, et cetera.
17400 refers to paternity, and 7611D refers only to a male. Mm-hmm. Do we have to rewrite these statutes?
I don't think so.
Ms. Hamilton, you may respond to Justice Chin's question, but your time is otherwise up.
Thank you, Your Honor. No, I don't believe we do. There has been case law in the last 10 years, and the statutes themselves have undergone this evolutionary change from paternity to parentage in an attempt to keep up with what the medically assisted reproductive techniques are in our society today. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. We'll hear now from Ms. Hank. I believe, Ms. Hank, my understanding from the clerk is that Ms. Jossen will be covering the rebuttal. Is that correct? All right.
Thank you, Your Honor. Shelley Hankey of Hankey & Williams on behalf of Alyssa B., petitioner. Is Melissa B. a parent? Absolutely not. Our statutory system, our statutory scheme, the United Uniform Parentage Act.
But didn't she intend to bring all three of these children into the world? And wasn't that the original agreement?
No. The original intent was...
They didn't go select the same donor, did they?
Yes, that occurred.
They didn't both agree to become pregnant at the same time?
No, they did not agree to become pregnant at the same time.
Approximately the same time?
No. No, sir. The Alyssa B. Wanted to be pregnant before when they had the discussions. They went to...
How old are the children?
The children are approximately 4 months apart, I think.
So approximately?
Approximately, but it was not a decision, no. It was not an agreement, no.
Why shouldn't we agree with the trial court, which ruled that Alyssa did indeed come within the statutory provisions that members of the bench and counsel earlier were talking about? And the trial court, did rule that Alyssa was a presumed parent. How do you get around that ruling?
I think our statutes provide for it. 7601 defines the parent-child relationship as a mother-child and a father-child. Those are the only two definitions that the statute provides.
But then, of course, you may remember the discussion I had with, I think it was Ms. Hamilton, earlier. We were talking about 7611, and I would like your response to 7611. There, as you may recall, it says that a man is presumed to be the natural father of a child if he receives the child into his home and openly holds out the child as his natural child. And yes, I would readily agree with you. The plain language of the statute doesn't say anything about a mother and child. But then we have 7650. Taking a look at 7650, that tells the reader, by the way, as much as practicable, you can use the mother and child relationship when a statute talks about a father and child relationship.
I agree with that. And in Karen C., the court did find that the statute can be used to establish the mother and child relationship. However, it never established that there could be more than one mother and child relationship. In Karen C., the mother was the non-biological person who had raised the child, and there was no other mother coming forward to claim maternity. So in Karen C., the court held, yes, we can apply 7611D in the gender-neutral fashion that counsel is suggesting to also establish a mother-child relationship, but there's nothing under 7611D that says we can have two mothers.
But doesn't our current law recognize that a child may have two parents of the same sex? either through registration as domestic partners or through adoption?
Only under those two manners, yes, Your Honor. So, by adoption, the parties could have adopted. They researched that and decided no.
And should that fact influence our decision and our language in Johnson versus Calvert?
I'm sorry, could you...
In Johnson versus Calvert, we said that for any child, California law recognizes only one natural mother.
That's
that seems to support your position.
Correct.
But the facts in that case do not.
Actually, I think the facts do. The courts held in Johnson that it was the biological parents who obtained the surrogate to have the child, so the surrogate was a gestational vehicle for producing the child, but this court held that that person is not the parent. It was the intent of Mr. and Mrs. Calvert who created this child. That was also in the circumstances of a marriage, and this court has traditionally supported and protected the parental rights and a family unit, and by stating that there's only one mother and that mother was Mrs. Calvert, it was to protect that family unit.
Do you agree with opposing counsel that the UPA limits the number of legal parents to two?
Yes.
So both sides agree to that basic point?
Yes.
Does that help you or does that hurt you?
I believe that helps.
How?
Because the statute also says that a parent is a mother-child relationship or a father-child relationship. Unless this court is expanding the definition of father to include a woman, that a woman can be a father.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's assume that instead of a sperm donor situation, as we have in this case, that the pregnancy resulted from an affair with a male, but you have all of the other facts are exactly the same. How many parents would we have in that situation?
I believe if it went to the court system, there would be two parents: the birth mother, which in this case is Emily, and in your theoretical question, then it would be the biological father. The sperm donor would be the legal father under our statutory scheme as it exists today.
Counsel, apart from the statute in question, why couldn't and why shouldn't this court decide this case on estoppel grounds?
Because estoppel was not established in this case. First of all, the four elements, the main estoppel piece that's missing is that Emily intended to have children regardless of the discussions that were the parties had prior to becoming pregnant, as well as the discussions that related to financial support, only came at the time of separation. The discussions for supporting the child, for Alyssa supporting the child through eternity, were not the basis for Emily becoming pregnant.
How is this case different from the Sorensen case, which was a heterosexual couple, but I believe the father there was barred on estoppel grounds from not paying child support?
If I recall the facts of Sorensen, it's that I believe the paternity rights were terminated in Sorensen. Am I mixing my cases at this point?
No, I don't think so.
Once the parental rights are terminated for custody visitation purposes, then there is no obligation to support child support. I believe there have been several cases that this court has ruled on, as well as appellate courts, that upon the termination of paternity rights, the obligation is also terminated.
Following up on Justice Moreno's question about estoppel, were we to find that the prerequisites for estoppel existed here, contrary to your view that they don't, would that be sufficient to impose a support obligation on your client without determining that your client is a parent?
I believe the answer to that would be no. I think before any obligation to support arises, the person has to be determined to be a parent to begin with. I believe the theory is that if there was no discussion, no argument, that perhaps the contractual rights could be utilized, but if the party who had signed or who had agreed to support and had it written and signed and sealed went into the court system, I believe that would be terminated. Any prior attempt at collecting would be terminated because she would not be a parent in this case.
So only parents can be charged with support, and for us to have your client held liable for support, we'd have to find she was a parent.
Yes.
According to you. Going back to your issue about two mothers, you say the statute speaks of a child has a mother and a child has a father. But as the world has moved forward in science, a child can potentially have two mothers, whether it's under the presumption of holding the child out to be her own or biologically or giving birth to it. In this case, there's no potential male claiming parenthood. Is that not correct?
That's correct.
Isn't there a state public policy that a child shall have two parents?
I believe the public policy is that whenever possible, the child should have two parents. But as the court has indicated, with technology as it is, that isn't always the case. Under 7611, the legislature has afforded women, whether they're married or not, the right to bear children through artificial insemination without having a paternity action against them or in order to establish a father. That same statute also affords men the right to donate semen without the fear of liability for child support. That's what's occurred in this case. Both parties, Alyssa and Emily, took advantage of 7613, and both had artificial insemination, and both produced children.
Didn't Alyssa also claim Emily, actually all three of them, as dependents on her tax return?
Yes, Your Honor.
And didn't she name Emily as a beneficiary of her life insurance?
At one time, yes, Your Honor.
And didn't they both breastfeed all three children?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is this beginning to sound like to you?
That I shouldn't breastfeed somebody else's children. I believe that those facts are all important to what the parties were, the behaviors of the parties at the time, but none of that rises to the legal definition of parent.
I assume that you would agree that what's just been described would be receiving and holding out within the meaning of the statute. You would agree with that?
I would agree that that's what the Justice Chin intended, but I don't believe that that happened in this case. I believe that Alyssa received the child into the home. I believe that she deducted the children or used the children as deductions for tax returns. She did not hold the children out as her natural children.
Well, I mean, assuming that certainly what he described looks like that. I think most people who looked at those facts would agree that that's true. But my question would be, is this nevertheless an appropriate case in which to rebut that presumption of motherhood by demonstrating Alyssa's lack of a biological tie, or does that matter?
No, I think that's the legislature's job. If the legislature intended for same-sex partners and their progeny to be a family unit, then the legislature would define it so. It would not be up to this court to stretch the existing laws to cover the unusual circumstances, which may become less unusual as we go forward.
So didn't your client treat these children as her own?
In some ways, yes.
And didn't she tell a prospective employer that she had triplets?
I don't believe that was the facts. I don't believe that she told a prospective employer. I believe that within the family and the friends, I believe that they spoke of the children as triplets, as their children. I believe that the UPA had the legislative intent was to eliminate the stigma of illegitimacy. by making two women parents of this child, that does not, of the children produced, that does not advance that legislative intent. The illegitimacy by its terms, by the definition, is children that were born outside of a legal marriage. Illicit.
That further the legislative aim that you acknowledged of recognizing that each child would have two parents?
By having two mothers would recognize, would further that aim? I believe that that's not accurate. I don't believe it furthers that aim. I think it's trying to, I think that would place the court in a position of stepping into the legislature's realm. It is up to the legislature to tell us what the state policy is, and that the legislative, the laws are then voted on by the public. And recently, the courts and the public in this state has clearly said one man, one woman equals marriage. The legislature also clearly stated its intent when creating Family Code Section 297, especially 297.5. The fact that the legislature was silent on certain issues, for example, what about the children that are produced and that parents do not, the same-sex parents do not register under the Act? If the legislature was silent, then we have to presume, the presumption is that the legislature intended to be silent on that issue. And until the state of California, the legislature and the public accepts two same-sex partners and their children as a family unit, the courts can't stretch the existing law.
It goes back to Sharon S., where it's established that you can have two same-sex parents by way of adoption.
Exactly. The courts have, the legislature has allowed for adoption of same-sex partners.
By way of judicial interpretation under Sharon S.
So the legislature was then, the legislature then went back and created the law to support that decision.
Well, we're faced with a statute here that was written in about 1975, whereas it's been mentioned these techniques and possibilities didn't exist. Is it not appropriate for us to consider, as times have evolved, how you might apply the statute in circumstances the legislature never could have contemplated, leaving the child, in this case, still with two parents, albeit with the same sex?
I believe that this court has an obligation fulfill the legislative intent. I also, in reading the legislative intent, I find nothing to indicate that the legislature intended there ever to be two mothers absent adoption or registration under 297.5.
About Section 7650, what's the legislative intent behind that particular provision?
My reading of that is that it goes to, it refers back to 7611, which again is, it's the presumption of paternity. Granted, we've allowed for a mother for maternity, but only one mother. There's nothing under Johnson, under the code sections that allows for two mothers absent adoption or registration under 297.5. Prior to what's going on in this case, all the cases held that a person in Alyssa B's position, the non-biological partner, is not a parent under the UPA. Curiel, West, Nancy S., all held from the early 90s, all held she was not a parent under the UPA for custody visitation purposes. So to now twist to say, well, but she should be a parent for purposes of support, is inconsistent. Either she's a parent or she is not a parent. And after those cases in which all of the courts invited the legislature to speak to address this issue, the legislature spoke, created 297.
Why would the legislature approve an arrangement where a child has two mothers in an adoption, but not under these facts?
Because the legislature specifically allowed for adoption, the adoption process.
Yeah, but why? In other words, what would be the public policy as far as the legislature is concerned to permit it in the adoption context but not in this context?
Because under adoption, it's two parties intentionally undertaking both the obligations and the rights of parenthood. not being forced into taking the obligation of parenthood, which is what is occurring in this case, or attempted to be occurring in this case. So when two parties, whether they're same-sex or heterosexual, go to the trouble and the time and the effort to adopt a child, then both parties are saying, both persons are saying, I want to be a parent and I'm willing to live up to all my obligations that are created under the law. In a case where the parties step outside those parameters of protection and have artificial insemination under, say, 7613, where the parties, they agree to have children, but neither person has stepped up to the plate to say, I also want the obligation to the other person's children, then it is not up to the courts to stretch that. It is up to the legislature to address it.
May I ask you this? Under 7611 subdivision D, it says he, referring to the father, receives the child into his home and openly holds out the child as his natural child. If the legislation said she, would your client come within its terms? Is it strictly the gender designation?
I don't believe so, because everybody from in the underlying facts of the case that came out at trial, the preschool knew that Emily was the natural mother of the twins and Alyssa was the natural mother of Chance. She did not hold the children out, Emily's children out, as her natural children.
What does natural mother mean in this context?
Birth mother.
What do you have to support that conclusion?
The conclusion that
the term natural mother, as interpreted in the recent decisions by this court, is limited only to biological mother.
I believe it's in the definitional framework of the statute. I believe the courts have created a legal parent that is not necessarily biologically connected or the birth mother. But as the term natural applies in the statute, it's my understanding that refers specifically to the birth mother.
So it's your position that under 7611D, only a male can qualify as a father by bringing the child into his home. A woman can never do that.
She cannot be the father. She can be determined to be the
woman. A woman can never qualify as a parent by bringing a child into her home, telling the world that this is my child.
Now, Karen C. says that we can do that. That in Karen C., the child was born of a mother who did not want the child, who I believe then, they believe, went back to Guatemala. And the woman handed the child to Letitia, who then mothered the child until the child was age 10, and then Department of Child Support Services became involved and at first blush said that because Letitia was not the mother, the biological mother, she's not a mother, and 7611D was allowed under those circumstances to establish a mother-child relationship.
7611D, in spite of the fact that it says he, can mean she.
Yes.
So you rest on the fact that you don't interpret the word natural as having any application here.
Natural has no application to Alyssa with regard to the twins. That's correct.
Because of the lack of a biological tie?
Because of the lack of the biological
tie. Well, again, taking you back to subdivision D of section 7611, which we have mentioned a number of times, man is presumed to be the natural father of a child. Focusing on the word natural, is it then your view that, looking at the statute as worded, that a man would have to be the biological father in order to come within the natural father provision?
No, he would have to hold the child out as his natural child. Not that he has to be the biological father, but he holds the child out, such as in Duncan v. Bosky.
Now, let's suppose that this court were to take the view that we should read the statutes at issue in a gender-neutral way. Listening to you, you would make a distinction with respect to a man. You take a view different from that pertaining to women, is that right? Your view is that here, because your client has no biological tie to the twins, she doesn't come within the 7611 provision, is that right?
That's correct, because if we apply 7611 to this case, it's clear that Emily is the natural, the mother, is the biological mother, and therefore Emily would would be the mother of the children under 7611D, since they're, in theory, could be competing moms.
But since we said in, In Re Nicholas, that there, you may recall, the male who wanted to be recognized legally as the father of the child in question had no biological tie whatsoever to the child. But there, this court considered him a presumed father. Now, one could easily argue, at least in my view for purposes of oral argument, that, well, if we did that in Nicholas, why shouldn't we do the same thing here?
Because Nicholas was, one, a dependency case, and number two, there was no competing other father. The father in Nicholas, the man in Nicholas had lived with him. His name was on the birth certificate. It was absolutely not...
Who is the competing father figure in this case?
Exactly. In this case, it would be a competing mother figure. In other words, we can't... It would be stretching to the absurd to say that a mother, a woman, can be a father. She is either a mom or she is...
Why can't we have a biological mother, as we have with Emily, and... taking a look at the statutory provision at issue, have a presumed parent within the provision of 7611 read together with section 650?
Because 7611 is a statute that is a rebuttable presumption, and it can be rebutted by clear evidence, clear and convincing evidence, such as in a father, if we're talking biology from a father's standpoint, if he goes and has a blood test, he's not the father. That rebuts or can rebut section 7611. In this case, Alyssa would be able to rebut the presumption because she is not the mother. Emily is the mother, and she is not the father because she is not, she cannot be the father under those circumstances.
Well, leaving aside the statutory difficulties, turning to policy considerations, when one takes a look at the statutory scheme at the issue, 7570, that's where the legislature declares there is a compelling state interest in establishing paternity for all children. Establishing paternity is the first step toward a child support award, which in turn provides children with equal rights and access to benefits, including but not limited to social security, health insurance, etc., etc. What about the argument that given this express declaration by the California legislature, one can reasonably come to the conclusion that implicit in that express declaration is a recognition of the importance of having two parents instead of simply one, especially when, as here, financial support of the children is of paramount importance. And the financial support up to now has fallen to the taxpayers of this state.
I believe, once again, that we have to defer that to the legislature to make that definition. If we were to read 7650 in a gender-neutral fashion, meaning that we can establish maternity as well as paternity, then Emily would still be the mother and Alyssa would still not be the father, because Alyssa cannot be a father. She could possibly be a parent, but that isn't a definition under our statutory code. That's what this court is being asked to accomplish, is to create a new definition of parent, meaning a second mom if a person does not comply with adoption codes or 297.5 by registering, then this court is being asked to completely abrogate the legislature's intent for 297.5. In 297.5, there was an opt-out provision. So if the court were to now rule that 7611D can apply to this case, the partners who may have been registered prior to January 1, 2005, who opted out, could now be pulled right back in to parenthood by the court's ruling in this case that Alyssa is a parent. It would completely abrogate the legislative intent for 297.5.
If your client had been a male, would you be making the same arguments?
I believe if my client had been a male, the first thing he would have said was, I want a paternity test, and he would have been excluded at that point. Because he, even had he, had my client been a man, brought the child in, lived with the child for that period of time, the party separated when the children, when the twins were 18 months old. And I believe that the courts have held that there's some type of time limit in forcing a man to be a parent if he's not biologically connected under those circumstances. And I believe that age limit is age 3.
But aren't you leaving aside or not taking into account the facts that I think Justice Chin, way earlier in the proceeding, pointed out, and I thought to some degree you acknowledged the recitation of the facts as set forth by Justice Chin, that here there was a holding out of being a parent to the twins.
I disagreed with Associate Justice Chin in that my client did not hold the children out in the school system. The parties, the doctors all knew that she was not the natural, the children were not her natural children.
Didn't they both identify themselves as co-parents of Rye at an organizational organization arranging care for his Down syndrome?
I believe that's accurate.
If I understand your position, you're arguing that the presumption of paternity shouldn't arise, but even if it does, it's rebuttable by proof that there's no biological connection. Is that?
That's correct.
Is that your position?
That's correct.
And what you're saying is that if all of the facts were exactly the same, except for it being a man and a woman instead of two women, that the, and if your client was the man, if the presumption arose of paternity because of accepting the child into the home and holding the child out as his own, nevertheless, that presumption is rebuttable based on proof that he is not the biological father.
That's correct. And Duncan B. Bosky tells us that when the parties first filed for the paternity action, the courts held, the trial court held that he was not a parent under the UPA and therefore could not take advantage of the 7611D statute saying that he had held the child.
I mean, it seems pretty clear to me that if you apply the presumption of parenthood section to the facts of this case, the presumption arises. I mean, I don't see any way around that. Then the question is, well, what happens after that?
You may respond, but your time is otherwise up, Ms. Hanke.
Thank you. I would disagree that the presumption arises, and if it does arise, it would have to be applied on the maternal end, and if it were applied on the maternal end, Alyssa is still not a parent because Emily is the mother. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hanke. We'll hear now from Ms. Jocelyn by way of rebuttal.
May it please the court. I'd like to try to address some of the issues that have been raised today.
I do have a question. Before you run out of your time.
Specifically, I'd like to start by stating what we're urging this court to do in this case. We're urging this court to apply Section 7613 equally, regardless of the marital status or registration status of the two people who intentionally agreed to procreate a child through artificial insemination.
Would you do you think I can ask a question? As I mentioned earlier, I do have a question. You don't have much time in this case for rebuttal. It's a very complex case, and I would appreciate if you would be kind enough to respond to the questions that the bench has. You may have heard the arguments by Ms. Hanke before, and if I remember correctly, we were talking, or Ms. Hanke was talking, about the importance of having a biological tie. Ms. Hanke argued to this court that here, Alyssa has no biological tie and therefore doesn't come within the presumed parent status of 7611. what is the significance here of our decision in Nicholas H.? I presume you're familiar with that decision. If not, I'll help you out.
I am familiar, Your Honor. In Nicholas H., this court held that the fact that Thomas was not the child's biological parent did not necessarily rebut his presumption of parentage, and we are asking that this court apply that rule equally to a woman. And so the presumption arises in this case because Alyssa clearly took the child into her home and held them out as her own, and as in Nicholas H., the presumption is not necessarily rebutted by her lack of biological connection.
Did she hold them out as her natural child, as opposing counsel has said she did not?
We believe that the important elements that allow the presumption to arise is holding the child out as one's own child, as telling the world that this is your child, and most importantly, really, that the child believes that you are a parent. And the evidence in this case is very, very clear that she did hold these children out as her children. She referred to them as her triplets, and the children did, in fact, establish an actual parent-child bond with Alyssa as one of their two parents.
What if we didn't have a sperm bank involved in this case? The example I posed earlier, where you do have a biological male, and conclusively prove fatherhood by that individual. I guess my question is, would your argument be the same after agreeing that the UPA provides for only two parents, or does the fact that a sperm bank is involved in this case is that an important factor?
Well, certainly under Section 7613B, the fact that the sperm that was used in this case was provided to a physician necessarily means that the donor of the sperm is not treated in law as the legal parent. And so in this case, we only have two possible people who could be the child's legal parents. If they had not received the sperm through a physician, if they had gotten it from somebody else without that physician involvement, then there would be competing presumptions. And as this court has done in other cases, in Johnson and Jesusa, this court would have to weigh the various competing interests and determine which two of those people were the child's legal parents.
Putting aside the Uniform Parentage Act, does the doctrine of estoppel have any role in this case?
We believe that the elements of estoppel are all complied with here, and that would be another grounds for holding.
If we were to go by way of estoppel, would we thereby make Alyssa a parent?
Yes, I believe that if you held that she was a parent by estoppel, that would also bring forth the rights and responsibilities of parenthood. But we would urge this court not to decide this case based on estoppel grounds, because it doesn't provide the level of clarity and surety for parents and children who intentionally bring children into the world through assisted reproduction. Deciding this case based on Section 7613 allows these children to have their parentage determined immediately from the moment of birth, and allows the parents and children to know and have clarity about the legal relationship between the parents and children.
Well, to follow up on that, I mean, does it really provide that the kind of clarity that you think it does? I mean, one of the problems with this idea of intention as being dispositive is that it sort of goes both ways. It could be very fact-specific and could be based on disputed facts, as a matter of fact. Let's suppose that Alyssa were a male in this situation, not biologically related to Emily's children, but supported the decision for artificial insemination, didn't sign any agreement consenting to it, and suppose that the argument were going the other way, that this man wanted to share custody of the twins and Emily didn't want him to. You know, if we agree with you, wouldn't we end up in the position of saying that her fundamental right to parent now can be intruded upon by this former boyfriend, because we'd be saying he would be entitled to share custody and child-rearing decisions, and she doesn't want him to?
Well, there's nothing inconsistent with the Constitution or Troxell specifically with this court defining who is a legal parent, and with this court saying that a person who intentionally brings a child into the world with the intention of parenting that child is a legal parent. And in fact, there are many situations where a person who is not biologically related to a child is determined to be that child's legal parent. There may be cases where a husband is not biologically related to the child. There may be men who sign voluntary.
But it doesn't respond to Justice Brown's point that were the circumstances involving a male and the woman did not want that male to have joint custody or authority to bring up the child with her, she would be forced to permit that. Are you allowing that that is, yes, true?
Yes, it would be our position that she would be forced to share the parenting role with that man, that having, with Emily having agreed to bring a child into the world with another person, whether it be a woman or a man.
So you're just saying that the mere fact that there was an oral agreement, he supported her desire to be artificially inseminated, that's enough, and now she is yoked to this person that, you know, and all her child-rearing decisions from now on?
It is our opinion that if there is clear evidence that both parties did engage in this procreative conduct with the intent that they would both parent the child, that they both must be treated in law as the legal parents, and if the parties did not agree in the future about if their relationship ended and they had disagreements about the child, that just as in any other situation where parents don't agree,
I mean, doesn't that really undermine all of the sort of clear legal standards like domestic partnership or adoption where there's a clear commitment to do something and both people have agreed to it? I mean, if we agree with you, that seems to me to open up a lot of possibilities for intrusions on parental roles by people, you know, relative strangers, in effect.
Well, again, this was a joint endeavor, and in the hypothetical situation that you're presenting, it's also a joint endeavor. And having agreed jointly to bring a child into the world, that person has opened themselves up to the possibility that another person...
But the statute speaks in terms of spouses, the marital relationship. If a husband agrees that this should, that the wife should proceed this way, Justice Brown's question, which I find does raise troubling issues, addresses any two people who at any given moment say, well, you go ahead and be inseminated and have this child. It brings strangers into the parenting relationship. You try to bring it under Section 7613, but that speaks of husband and wife, a marriage.
Correct.
And we don't have a registered domestic partnership here, and we don't have a marriage.
Correct. As the Attorney General pointed out earlier, although Section 7613A does speak in terms of husbands and wives, there is an overarching mandate of the UPA that it be applied without regard to marital status. And one of the primary purposes of the UPA is to protect children who should not be punished for steps that their parents could have taken.
Protect them from illegitimacy. So the stated purpose of the statute comports with marital status shouldn't preclude application here, but that still doesn't address the two people of the same sex or two women.
Well, the UPA also mandates, as this court has pointed out, that the UPA be applied without regard to gender insofar as practicable. Because Section 7613A is not about establishing who a child's biological parents are. In fact, it's specifically about determining parentage based on the person's conduct in bringing children into the world. There simply is no practical reason why it should not be applied equally, regardless of the sex of the person who intentionally brought this child into the world.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jocelyn. Well, Justice Brown, if you have one more question.
I was just going to ask if any oral agreement would be sufficient. In other words, how would we know when we've got enough to signify intention?
In most cases, and then certainly in this case, the consent of the two parties will be clear. This was an issue that the Court of Appeal actually addressed in Bazanka, where Mr. Bazanka claimed that he should not be held responsible for child support because he had failed to sign the written agreement at the time of the implantation of the embryo. And the Court of Appeal rejected his argument, saying that it was clear that his oral agreement had led to the production of a child, and having agreed to produce a child, he simply could not walk away from that responsibility.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Jocelyn. Thank you, Ms. Reed-Spangler, Ms. Hamilton, Ms. Henke. The matter stands submitted.